Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get straight to the campaign trail. Republican Party Chairman Reince Priebus is reportedly furious that Donald Trump will not endorse two party leaders who are facing primary challenges this month, House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senator John McCain. Also, Tea Party Congressman Tim Huel's camp lost his primary in Kansas yesterday, and a prominent Silicon Valley Republican says she's with Hillary Clinton. Joining us now is Here and Now political analyst Paris Denard, a Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And I want to start at the House level here. How big of a deal is this Huel's camp loss to Roger Marshall in Kansas for the conservative, the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party?
Well, I think we've seen a transition, and I think that the Tea Party side of the party has been going through some changes, and they have to find themselves to be relevant in this new election cycle. The one thing that is in common with Mr. Trump and with Dr. Marshall is that they're both outsiders, and I think the people are rejecting establishment types, rejecting people who don't want to get things done, and they want to be with candidates and people who are about cutting deals and bringing an outside perspective to Washington, D.C.
So you see Marshall as an outsider, even though many people have described him as the more kind of mainstream GOP figure.
He comes from the private sector. He's a doctor. He's an outsider. And I think that he brings that perspective. And he was very well respected with his constituency groups and who endorsed him and the people who are backing him there in the state. And he brings a level of expertise as it relates to healthcare. And so I think, yeah, he is an outsider like Mr. Trump, bringing a business perspective to Washington, D.C.
What do you think of what's happening in the Trump campaign? There are reports of unhappy staff members, reports of people mailing it in. Trump won't back down in this fight with the Kahn family. He's now said he's not going to endorse Paul Ryan or John McCain. I mean, what do you make of this, Paris, for the Republican Party?
Look, Mr. Trump is running an unconventional campaign, and he's not a traditional political candidate, so things are going to be run differently. If you want to work on the campaign, you want to work on the team, you have to fall in line and do what the candidate wants. That's how all elections are. With this, I found it particularly interesting that Chairman Priebus is up or allegedly furious that he won't, that Mr. Trump won't support or endorse Speaker Ryan or some other people. I want him to be just as furious at the nominees who signed a pledge and said they would support Mr. Trump if he became the nominee. And they have not done that.
But shouldn't the example come from Trump, who wants everybody who signed that pledge to support him, and now he's saying he's not going to support Ryan or McCain, who both have said they support him?
If you think Senator McCain is going on the campaign trail for Donald Trump, we have another conversation to have. That's not the case. There's no love lost between the two. And I think that Speaker Ryan played around with whether or not he was going to support Mr. Trump. And so Mr. Trump is probably playing politics just the way he did as well. But yes, the leadership has to come from Mr. Trump, but also has to come from Chairman Priebus. He needs to call for more party unity and call for people to get in line and get behind Mr. Trump and lead, be the conductor for this Trump chain. Because if we don't, we will lose to Hillary Clinton. We have to have unity. But I will say this, in all honesty and fairness, Mr. Trump and the campaign has to be more disciplined and has to stay on message. This is a lot going on the Democrat side with a mass exodus at the DNC, the emails and the burn your bus blow up at the convention. There's a lot to talk about the Democrat side, and we're being distracted by some of the things that Mr. Trump focuses on, unfortunately.
That's Here Now political analyst Paris Denard, who is a Republican strategist. Paris, thanks as always.
My pleasure, my friend.
Woke up this morning. State of freedom.
Bethel AME Church in the Jamaica Plains section of Boston was rocking Monday night as hundreds of people of all faiths gathered for what the Reverend Dr. William Barber calls a revival tour. Reverend Barber spoke at last week's Democratic National Convention. He said the heart of America's democracy is in need of a moral defibrillator.
Is there somebody that has a heart for the poor? A heart for the vulnerable, then stand up.
Reverend Barber is well known in North Carolina, where he's a pastor and president of the state's NAACP chapter. But he's also one of the organizers of the Moral Mondays movement in Raleigh, weekly vigils calling for a progressive agenda. Now he's traveling the country, rallying others to take a stand. And he joins us now. Reverend Barber, welcome to Here and Now. At the DNC, you said, when religion is used to camouflage meanness, we know we have a heart problem in America. Wasn't that a bit of a swipe at conservative evangelicals who politically and socially might have a very different set of values than you?
Well, it wasn't a swipe. It was a direct statement that anybody, I don't care what you call yourself, you can say you're conservative. But I would say, speaking the truth in love, if you're conservative, biblically, you want to conserve love, not hate. You want to conserve justice, not injustice. You want to conserve mercy and not meanness. And when we see persons who are so quiet, who claim to be, Christian or religious, and they're quiet on the issue of health care, they're quiet on the issue of public education, they're quiet on the issue of living wages, they're quiet on the issue of justice for immigrants and fair treatment for the LGBT community, and many times quiet on the issue of dealing with the proliferation of guns, but they're so loud when it comes to castigating and sometimes demonizing people in the LGBT community and others. That is, in fact, counter. When they say they're going to put their support behind a candidate that is openly racist and openly promoting a xenophobia, that is deeply problematic. And we've seen that before in history. You know, there were those who claimed to be religious, claimed to be Christian, who stood up against Dr. King, who in the early, late 1800s stood up against those who tried to reform this country and move it away from the vestiges of slavery. So we've seen this before, and it has to be challenged.
And do you see your revival tour as equal parts political and moral?
I wouldn't separate the two. I think that's a false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. The Bible is deeply political, but it's not left versus right or Republican versus Democrat. If you read the scriptures, for instance, Isaiah 10 says, "Woe unto those who legislate oppressive decrees." That was a direct challenge to the political structures 2,600 years ago. Or you get Jeremiah 22, where it says, "Go down to the king's palace and tell him not to pass policies that hurt children and hurt women." So it's not a Democrat versus Republican politics, but it's calling us to move our politics to higher ground. And we've seen this. Every major progressive thing that has happened in America, from the ending of slavery, women's suffrage, the New Deal, the civil rights movement, always had a deep moral underpinning where people moved away from their particular parties and said there's some things higher based on our deepest principles and deepest values.
Reverend, we're at a tough place today in America in terms of race relations. Young men of color are being incarcerated at an alarming rate. The relationship between the black community and the police is volatile and deeply strained. How do you engage young people who are cynical about the political process to join your so-called moral revolution?
Well, we have a large contingency of young people in the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina, for instance. Many of them were involved in civil disobedience. One of the ways you do it is you reframe the imagination. Young people are not so much interested, again, in this left-right issue. They're interested in how do we deal with some issues that are just right versus wrong. And the fact of the matter is we have this legitimate rage and outrage about the killing of African-Americans, unarmed African-Americans by police. That's not an anti-police position. It's actually a pro-police position, because bad cops make it bad for good cops, and good cops would be challenging bad cops. And so young people are saying, we are going to challenge racism, but that's not the only racism. You have the false incarceration. You have the high incarceration rates of African-Americans that are deeply different than our population rates in this country. We not only must deal with those issues, we must deal with race in terms of policies like voter suppression policies. For instance, when you deny living wages, 54% of African Americans make less than a living wage. So we need a grown-up conversation about race. We need to ask this question: why is it that in the poorest counties and areas of this country, they continue to elect candidates who are the most adverse to the policies that would help the poor, when in fact you have 8 million more poor white people than you have black, you have 5 million more white people than Latinos that are poor? We need a grown-up conversation about race and class in this country, and our young people are pushing us to do that.
Reverend, in your life, who's inspired you and shaped your ideas on civil rights and justice?
Well, you know, my father, I was introduced at 5 years old. I didn't really have a choice. My daddy was invited to come back to North Carolina to help desegregate public schools, his home area. I was born in Indianapolis 2 days after the March on Washington. the joke in my family was that I waited to the 30th to see what would happen on the 28th. But my father was called back to North Carolina. I entered segregated public schools so I could be a part of the first to go to the elementary school. Now, this is in 1968. This is 14 years after Brown. People need to understand Brown versus Board of Education happened, but 14, 15 years later, many areas in the South were still not even attempting desegregation. So early on, I learned from my father, who was a trained theologian as well, is that you cannot be Christian and not be concerned about justice. You cannot be Christian and just be limited to your work inside the sanctuary and have no concern about the public square.
The Reverend William Barber is president of the North Carolina NAACP and co-organizer of the Revival Tour for a Moral Revolution of Values. Reverend Barber, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. God bless. Take care.
This is Here and Now. 20 years ago, if you were watching TV in America, you were probably a Seinfeld viewer. The show about a group of New York friends aired on NBC from 1989 to 1998. It became the number one show in America and now airs all around the world in syndication. It was created by Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David and was groundbreaking in more ways than you might think. Jennifer Cation Armstrong has a new book about it called Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. She joins us. And Jennifer, I want to start with an episode that came pretty early on and caused some controversy. It centers around all the characters waiting at a Chinese restaurant. Here's a clip where George Costanza, played by Jason Alexander, is upset because he's been waiting to use the phone and someone cuts in front of him.
You know, we're living in a society. We're supposed to act in a civilized way. Does she care? No. Does anyone ever display the slightest sensitivity over the problems of a fellow individual? No. No. A resounding no.
Hey, sorry I took so long.
Oh, that's okay, really. Don't worry.
Now, why was this episode at the Chinese restaurant so groundbreaking?
I want to say I feel like that was such a great clip because it's like the thesis of the whole show. This was a particularly groundbreaking episode because nothing happens. I mean, essentially, like by TV sitcom standards at that time, nothing happens. The plot is, you know, the log line is they go to a Chinese restaurant, they wait for a table, they don't get it, they leave. That doesn't sound like a story to network executives. So this was the one time when the network executives kind of really said, no, we don't think you can do this. And Larry David put up a fight enough and they let him go with it. And it turned out to be a huge turning point for the show because critics got it. Critics understood that it was funny because there was no actual plot. And a bunch of things happened, like that phone thing. And Elaine goes to try to steal an egg roll off someone's plate who's sitting there, which we've all sort of wanted to do while waiting in a restaurant. I often stare at people, you know, glower at them angrily to try to get them to leave or sooner. So there's a lot that goes on. And this, to me, kind of embodies when they said later, they kind of made the joke that really stuck, that they were a show about nothing. To me, this is the nothing. It's they made something out of nothing.
They also, you point out in this book that one of Larry David's lines about this show was, no hugging, no learning.
Exactly. And this is the key to the show, to a large extent, is that that's what made it so different, too. No character development. It's not like they got to the end and they had all changed and grown and matured. This was stripping down the sitcom form to purely be funny. And that's it. And that's a bold move because you have to be very funny then.
And when you watch it today, and it is on, and you've pointed out in this book that they've made billions of dollars since the show went off the air on syndication and other ways that people watch Seinfeld. When you watch it today, it's hard to tell what's a later episode and what's an earlier episode because, as you say, the characters don't really change that much. But also, it makes sense today almost as if it were being done right now, except for, you know, some of the technology is different.
Exactly. This is why it tends to live on, I think, is that it's still about these everyday irritations, right? That's what the show is about. And guess what we haven't figured out how to do? Get rid of everyday irritations. It doesn't matter how much technology we have. We're still having to sort of deal with each other. Like, what are our obligations to each other? And why do I have to do this and not that? And why do I have to be mad at this person and not this person? You know, that sort of thing.
One of the characters that is known so well by people who have watched this show is the soup Nazi, who's based on a real person in New York. Here he is in a scene with Jerry Seinfeld and Jason Alexander.
I didn't get any bread.
Just forget it. Let it go.
Excuse me. I think you forgot my bread.
Bread? $2 extra.
$2? But everyone in front of me got free bread.
You want bread?
Yes, please.
$3!
What?
No soup for you.
And the cashier grabs the soup. You can hear it there. But this tiny part in Seinfeld, played by Larry Thomas, has ended up changing his life completely, and now he's still making money on Seinfeld on being the soup Nazi.
He very good-naturedly continues to play the soup Nazi at events. People will pay him, fly him out. He goes to conventions. He signs soup ladles. as you can imagine, most of his time is spent saying no soup for you to people, and they get a real big kick out of that. He has to keep his mustache because, you know, he still has to play the soup Nazi. And it's just fascinating because this was one episode. People often think it was more. Technically, he was also on the finale, but everyone was on the finale. You know, so this is one character part that this guy probably thought, oh, I'll just do this thing and forget about it. And here he is 20 years later, still playing the soup Nazi. I'm sort of fascinated by the fact that Seinfeld seems like it's taken over his life a lot more than, say, Jerry Seinfeld's at this point.
I want to talk to you briefly about some of the controversy that this show has had over the years. Here is an early controversy where they went to the mall in the suburbs and discussed parking in a handicap spot. Here it is.
What if a handicapped person needs it?
Oh, come on. They don't drive.
Yes, they do.
Have you ever seen a handicapped person pull into a space and park?
Well, the space is there. They must drive.
No, they don't. If they could drive, they wouldn't be handicapped.
So, if you can drive, you're not handicapped.
We're not going to be that long anyway. We got to get to the party.
Hey, I got news for you. Handicapped people, they don't even want to park there. They want to be treated just like everybody else. That's why those spaces are always empty.
He's right. It's the same thing with the feminists. You know, they want everything to be equal, everything. But when the check comes, where are they?
So this did not go over well with the network.
Yeah, that's – I'm sitting here cracking up. That's actually one of my most favorite, and it feels oddly relevant even today or especially today. But yeah, the network always kind of ended up letting them do what they wanted to, which is pretty incredible and obviously lends – itself, you know, this is why the show is still talked about. I think that if they had softened a lot of this, it would not still be something we'd be talking about.
Why did they get rid of the writers after every season? They almost all of the writers were fired at the end of every season.
Yeah, they usually hired a new batch. Mostly, you know, there were a couple of mainstays like Peter Melman and Larry Charles, but most of them came in as stand-ups. They didn't have a lot of or any TV writing experience. They would sort of come in and almost like use up their experiences that could be used as storylines for the show. And then they went on their way, usually to great profit and better success because they had been on Seinfeld. So it wasn't all bad. And at least the ones that I talked to weren't particularly bitter about this. But it did seem like they were almost like an idea farm more than anything else.
And when you look at the two people who were really behind this show, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld, and Larry David left at a certain point after the seventh season, although he did come back to do that finale that everyone hated. but when you look at those two and you look at what Larry David has done since and Curb Your Enthusiasm, which has a similar feel to it in that, you know, they bring in a guest character who does something atrocious to one of the characters who responds in an even more atrocious way and then gets blamed for it. Who was the real brains behind Seinfeld?
Well, you know, as I said, this was Jerry Seinfeld's show and obviously a name it was. But Larry David was really kind of the spark, it seems like, that ignited the whole thing, you know, and made it what it was. It was really the combination of them. I think they're kind of a Lennon and McCartney thing. You know, I think they balance each other really nicely, and especially for network television at that time. There's no way Larry David's sensibility by itself gets on the air. You know, and notice no one was knocking on his door to ask for a show. It was Jerry who brought him in. And I think that Jerry's kind of more affability, you know, mellowed out the Larry David existential dark edge that he brought too. But I think the two together are what makes it so special. I mean, I love Curb as well, and that's all Larry David all the time. But that's a different time and on HBO, so it works a little better.
What do you think Seinfeld's effect on New York City was? People have talked about this show making New York feel like a friendlier, more fun city to live in, and it coincided with the city turning around in the 90s.
That and Friends, I think, really, and then Sex and the City kind of brought up the tail end of that. But I do know people who moved to the city because of all of those shows. I do think that as somebody who grew up in the Midwest and moved to New York, it made it a little more accessible to me. Like, oh, I could do that.
And what about Seinfeld's impact on other television shows? How did it change TV? You say in this book it changed everything.
Well, it is a catchy subtitle, isn't it?
It is.
But it changed a lot in television because, to me, it kind of ushered in what we're now calling the golden age of television. You know, and the way we watch TV is so different. We obsess over it. We think it's smart. We're proud of watching TV. We don't claim to not have a TV anymore to sound cool. And this show elevated the form. It made sitcoms smart. And it also brought in the age of the antihero, in my opinion. I think it kind of greased the wheels for people to accept heroes on their television shows who are not necessarily great people and admirable people. I really do believe that people could accept Tony Soprano because they had already accepted these four who were not necessarily mafia killers, but, you know, also not necessarily paragons of humanity.
That's Jennifer Cation Armstrong, whose book is called Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. Jennifer, I'm a huge fan of Seinfeld, and I was a big fan of this book, so thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. The National Institutes of Health said today it's now testing a Zika vaccine in humans. It's just 2 days after the Centers for Disease Control warned pregnant women and their partners to stay away from one neighborhood in Miami where at least 15 people contracted the disease. Andrew Joseph is a reporter for our partners at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication. He's been covering the issue. Andrew, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew, what more do we know about the Zika vaccine that NIH is testing?
So this is actually the second Zika vaccine candidate to enter human trials. The first one was just last week, and it just goes to show there are a bunch of different efforts at developing a vaccine. It just shows there's a wide effort to combat the virus.
Now, on a call today with journalist Dr. Anthony Fauci at the NIH, said he hopes to move into the next phase of trials in January, but he said that depends on money. Let's listen.
Without congressional approval of additional funding for Zika efforts, the planning and preparation necessary to conduct a phase two trial will slow down significantly, effectively impeding our smooth process on the vaccine development front.
Andrew, President Obama had asked Congress to approve nearly $2 billion in emergency Zika funding back in February, but Congress didn't pass it. Is this local outbreak in Miami likely to move Congress to act at all?
It's a little bit unclear. Several senators, including both Florida senators, a Democrat and a Republican, have called for Congress to come back from recess to approve some emergency funding. But who knows if that'll happen. And it's kind of entering another level now. Tim Kaine, the vice presidential nominee, has also called for Congress to come back. But so far, Senate leaders haven't followed up with that.
And the NIH vaccine is not the only one in clinical trials. Who else is working on a vaccine, Andrew?
Sure. There's a company called Inovio that's developed a similar vaccine, and that's the one that entered human trials last week. And there are a couple other efforts, including one from the military and some other private researchers who are also developing vaccines. And they're all slightly different sort of approaches to developing a vaccine.
And how far along are they, or don't we know?
Some are still in animal models. These are the first to reach humans. And just because they're reaching humans, there's still a long way to go. These are the very first phases of a clinical trial when they're actually just testing them in healthy volunteers here in the United States and in Canada, just to make sure there's not some sort of horrible side effect before they start testing them in a larger number of peoples, in which case they'll start doing that in places where Zika is spreading.
And you're just back from a reporting trip to Miami, where officials are trying to contain Zika, at least in part of that city. What did you hear from people there? How worried are they?
You know, it's a huge range. Obviously, pregnant women, because of the fear of birth defects, are worried and are trying to take precautions. But if you're just out and about in that neighborhood, you know, one woman told me she was taking all necessary precautions, but she was taking out her trash in tank top and shorts. Hmm. Part of that is because it was like 95 degrees. But I think it's still going to take a little bit of time for the news to sink in. You know, there are a lot of businesses there that when I was there were kind of thriving. And I saw the news today that some outdoor restaurants are closing their patios, sort of outdoor exercise classes are being postponed or delayed or moved. So I think as the news continues to spread, like there's going to be more steps taken.
All right. Andrew Joseph is a reporter with our partner at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
It's here and now. Just two more days until the Olympics officially get started in Rio. Lots of attention will be paid to track and field, swimming, and gymnastics. But athletes in dozens of lower-profile sports are almost certain to bring home medals for the United States. Today in our series of conversations with Olympic medalists, we speak with fencer Seda Jacobson-Bobby, who won bronze in the individual women's saber event in Athens in 2004. She took home silver in the same event in 2008, as well as a bronze team medal that year in Beijing. Today, she's a mother of two, practicing law in Atlanta, Georgia. Seda, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So, Seda, let's go back to your first Olympics. You competed in Athens in 2004. It was the first time that your event, the individual saber, was included in the Games. For those of us not up on fencing, what is the individual saber competition? Describe it.
Well, first of all, I should explain that there are three different disciplines in fencing: foil, épée, and saber. Saber, which is my event, is the most fast-paced and explosive of the three. Touches are scored quickly with the cutting edge of the blade as opposed to the point. I think of it as comparable to a sprint in running. Hmm. I think it's the most fun, but I might be biased.
You were only 21 back then in Athens. What was that like for you competing there?
It was surreal, and I think most people who go to the Olympics would describe it that way. Hmm. It's like every competition that you've ever been to and no competition that you've ever been to. Everybody is so focused on making the Olympic team and competing in the Olympics that it has a very different feel to actually competing. Hmm. It was quite an experience.
At what point did you decide to compete in Beijing? Because you were a college student at the time.
I didn't know going into this sport that I would ever be competing in the Olympics. When I started, my event, Women's Saber, was not an Olympic event. Mm-hmm. It was only around 2002, 2003, when it was determined that Women's Saber would be in the Athens Games, that I decided that I wanted to make a run for it. I was in college at the time. I knew that I would need to solely focus on fencing for at least a few semesters to really have a good shot at the team and at doing well at the games. That was sort of my path.
You grew up in a fencing family, as I understand it. Tell us about that.
That's right. My entire family has fenced at some point or another.
Really?
My dad started when he was in college as a college freshman, and was pulled into the fencing gym by a new coach there, who, in fact, is still the coach at Yale today, Henry Haritunian. Hmm. Fell in love with it, competed in world championships in 1974. And then after he graduated, he sort of drifted away from the sport and came back to it again in 1996 when the Olympics were in Atlanta. His coach came down and stayed at our house, and coach told him about a club run by Arkady Berdan, who's my coach. Hmm. My dad started going down there for fun, and lo and behold, the entire family got pulled into it.
And you've got two children. You're going to get them into fencing?
Well, it might have already begun. I have a 3-year-old and an 8-month-old, and we've already started taking the 3-year-old over to the club on the weekends just to run him around a little bit. He's not actually fencing. He mostly just chases after tennis balls and basketballs and things like that. But he's definitely getting exposure to the sport.
Back to the Olympics. I mean, what was it like for you winning those medals in the two different games and then adjusting to sort of quote-unquote normal life back home?
It took a little while. After 2008, when I knew that I was going to be leaving the sport, to readjust to my new life. Fencing is such a travel-heavy sport to do it at a high level. You are constantly on an airplane, living out of a suitcase, going to some tournament or another overseas. And that really becomes your life. And in 2008, when I transitioned back to school and was no longer fencing, it took a little while to kind of redefine myself.
Mm-hmm. And when you left Beijing, as successful as you had been, did you sort of know that it was the end of your fencing career, your professional career?
I did. That was the plan going in. I knew that 2008 was going to be my last games. And as soon as I was done competing, I was going to be heading up to Michigan to start law school. I think that actually eased the transition a bit. But it still took a little bit of time while I was still very much identified myself as being a fencer to go back to being a student.
Any lessons from fencing or training in the fencing profession that you use in the courtroom?
Oh, everything. Everything about fencing translates to every other part of my life. And I think especially I'm a litigator, so I see parallels to fencing all the time. Every case it's like a bout in a way. You have your strategy, you have an opponent, you even have a referee. That's what I loved about the sport, and what I enjoy about law is that strategic aspect of it.
Do you still have connections to the sport and to your fellow Olympians?
Oh, absolutely. I still go over to the fencing club to say hello to everybody, see my coach, and that will always feel like home to me, and still keep up with my teammates. And I'm friends on Facebook with the women who I competed with for years from countries all over the world.
That's great. So in between your law practice and taking care of your kids, are you going to have any time to watch the games in Rio?
I will make time.
Nice.
I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. Sada Jacobson-Bobby won Olympic medals in fencing at the 2004 and 2008 Olympics. She now practices law in Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, while athletes go for the gold in Rio, marketers will be going for the green. Official sponsors will pay nearly $1 billion to associate their brands with the Olympic Games, but millions more will be spent on something known as ambush marketing, advertising that implies a connection to the Olympics when there actually is none. That's what Under Armour is trying to do in this ad that features the U.S. gymnastics team in training while a roll call of nations is chanted. Somalia, Bosnia, Cuba, Colombia, Ecuador, Mexico, Vietnam. Here and now, media analyst John Carroll joins us now. And John, first of all, who is Under Armour ambushing here?
Under Armour is ambushing Nike, which is ironic since Nike has been the greatest ambusher since Zorro. They have done it constantly at Olympics, Euro Cup, World Cup. This time around, though, they're the sponsor of the U.S. Olympic Committee and all its athletes. So they'll outfit them, including the women's gymnasts. So Under Armour sponsors the team but has no official connection to the Olympics.
And there's no Olympic logo or reference in this ad.
No, that's the ambush part of it. I mean, the implication is that somehow they're associated with the Olympics, and somehow they are, but technically they are not. So they leave it up to the viewer to sort of fill it in.
Is there anything the International Olympic Committee or Nike can do about this?
Probably not about the Under Armour campaign, but they do have restrictions, and they do go after people. In 1995, they went after Audi, saying that the four-ring logo that Audi has was too close to the five-ring logo of the Olympics. They've also sued...
Obviously, they didn't win that one.
No, they
because
did not.
They still got that logo.
Yeah, they sued a knitting club, which was having its own Olympics back in 2012. They also taped over the toilet paper logos on the toilet paper dispensers in London so that people wouldn't think that they were official sponsors.
So people may wonder, well, why does this matter so much? Well, roughly half of the IOC's $2.7 billion in operating budget comes from sponsorship revenue. So you can see why they would be very unhappy about this, but not very easy to police, especially in the age of social media.
No, I mean, there are some platforms that you absolutely cannot police. Snapchat, WhatsApp, Instagram are really hard. They can probably monitor Twitter, but overall, they have a real disadvantage in terms of social media.
And on the other hand, the IOC has loosened some restrictions.
Right. It used to be that the athletes have their own sponsors, and it used to be that the sponsors of athletes could not run ads during the Olympic broadcast. But they have loosened it up. They have some waivers that they've given to some people. So essentially, they've opened up that possibility, but it's a very narrow window.
Why do brands care so much about associating themselves with the Olympics?
Because people care about the Olympics. People get attached to the athletes, their stories. They 217 million Americans watch the London Olympics. So I think it's a big market that's engaged, and that's exactly what advertisers want. They want to connect with people who are engaged.
John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now and a mass communication professor at Boston University. We've got a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. The U.S. Supreme Court could rule as early as this week on a fight between Virginia schools and transgender students. The Los Angeles Times reports that the school board is asking the Supreme Court for an emergency order. It wants the court to overturn a lower court's decision that allows a transgender student to use the boys' bathroom. The 17-year-old student sued the Virginia school board after it required students to use bathrooms that match the gender on their birth certificate. And with the start of the school year fast approaching, this issue is gaining momentum across the country. More than 20 states have challenged the Department of Education's order that allows students to use bathrooms, dorms, and locker rooms that match their gender identity. So we'll keep an eye on the Supreme Court on this issue. Meanwhile, a clinic for transgender youth in Boston has noticed something that it can't explain. A high percentage of its transgender children and teenagers are growing up in adoptive homes. The rate of adoption among the clinic patients turns out to be 3 to 4 times higher than the overall adoption rate in the state. Martha Biebinger from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
2 years ago, when Nathan Tasker was 13, his mom drove him from his home in Melrose, Massachusetts, to attend a special transgender summer camp in Maine. Nathan says he was happy for the first time in years.
I finally was not alone.
But even at a camp for transgender youth, Nathan expected to be different because he's also adopted.
Well, I thought that, you know, I was just a package deal. Like, this only happens to one kid, like, in every place in the world. But I was like, you know what? There are a lot of adopted kids who are trans, and that's pretty amazing.
Nathan's doctors at Boston Children's Hospital started making the same connection last year.
We had been noticing that a seemingly high percentage of our patients were adopted or living with adoptive families.
Dr. Daniel Schumer treated transgender kids at Boston Children's Hospital for years. He moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan to open a similar program last year, but pored through the files in Boston before he left. He found that 8.2% of the 184 young people who've come to the clinic since it opened in 2007 were raised in adopted families. The adoption rate overall in Massachusetts is 2.3%.
There may be a true link between being adopted and being transgender. But another possibility is that adoptive families may be more likely to present to clinics for help for their transgender child.
There are a few reasons why. Adoption experts say it's a fact. Adopted children seek and receive more counseling and care. When it comes to transgender care, Schumer says families of adopted children appear less likely to be ashamed of their child and more likely to seek help. That idea resonates with Dr. Johanna Olson Kennedy, who runs a clinic for transgender youth in Los Angeles.
When parents have biological children that are transgender, what happens is a big blame game. I have heard many families say, well, you know, my husband has two gay cousins or my wife has a trans aunt.
Olson Kennedy says that does not happen with the families of adopted kids. There is no evidence of a transgender genetic connection. But could there be something about the experience of adoption that helps explain the link? Dr. Schumer says maybe.
As adoptive kids are becoming teenagers, they may more actively consider their gender identity in the context of their overall identity than kids that aren't adopted, that aren't going through as rigorous an identity thought process.
That's a new but reasonable assumption, says Adam Pertman, president of the National Center on Adoption and Permanency.
Identity and adoption is a complex issue. I mean, it's complex for everybody, but there's a whole nother layer for adopted people that sort of triggers, in many of them, a deeper look within themselves about identity. And maybe this is part of what they find.
I think it's a stretch, frankly.
That's Jameson Green, past president of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. He says all of these theories are interesting guesses, but just that.
People, in trying to understand what transness is and how it manifests and why some of us are this way, will elicit all kinds of conjectures.
Green has many of his own questions. He is, after all, adopted. Could there be something triggered by an early separation from the biological mother, or something neurological, linked to reasons a mother gives up her child for adoption?
It speaks to how little we actually know. There's much more to be learned about transness, about gender identity development in all people.
There appears to be just one other study on transgender adoption rates. In 1998, a Toronto clinic found a similarly high percentage of adoption among transgender youth than among children as a whole. The Boston researchers are presenting their findings at conferences and have submitted a paper for publication. It leaves the question about why there's a high adoption rate among transgender youth seen at some clinics open for discussion. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.